Life of Jesus, a devotional study by Melva Perkis. Book 5, Chapter 9, Help Thou Mine Unbelief. When the morning rays of the sun turned to gold the tops of Hermon, it was in truth the dawning of another day for Jesus and his three disciples. As they made their way down to the plains where men lived and toiled, there can be little doubt that, like Moses before them, they wist not that their faces shone. The three apostles had been shown something which even their master could not have taught them. Now, in the cool, sunlit air, they would be conscious of the peace which always follows communion with God. As soon as they reached the foot of the mount, they would reveal to their fellow disciples something of the wonder they had seen. They would tell them that there was no longer need for concern, whatever may befall. Jesus was the Son of God, and they had seen his glory. Yet this was not to be. Tell the vision to no man, until the Son of Man be risen again from the dead. This revelation was for them alone. An experience like that cannot be shared. No words could begin to convey what God's glory had revealed. This remains true today. If in God's grace there come moments when Christ enters into our hearts and we feel the strength of his presence and the power of his love, we are conscious that we have had one experience which we cannot share. There may be times when deep calls unto deep, and on some moorland tor, or in the flickering light of a winter fire, we unexpectedly find ourselves confiding in a kindred soul. These are rare and joyous hours. But such experiences can never be related with the intention of demonstrating the power and beauty of Christ in the human heart. Each one yearns for the hour of visitation and waits in hope and prayer. And one day he comes, and like Peter, James, and John, we find ourselves reluctant to leave the mountain heights and descend to the plains below. It was not surprising that the thoughts of the three disciples should be occupied by the things they had witnessed. The scribes had taught that Elijah would be revealed before the coming of the day of the Lord. They wondered how this might be, and what part the vision had in the course of events. "Master," they said, "why say the scribes that Elijah must first come?" Jesus did not hesitate to confirm the accuracy of the scribes' interpretation of the message of Malachi. He told them that it was true that before the final manifestation of the Messiah, Elijah would be sent to restore all things and to prepare for the establishment of the kingdom. Yet, as is so often seen in God's dealing with man, there was also a sense in which Elijah had appeared already in the person of John the Baptist, and the nation had done to him whatsoever it listed. The scribes had not the complete picture of the two Elijahs and the two advents of the Messiah. Jesus brings that out in a counter-question recorded by Mark. "How is it written of the Son of Man that he must suffer many things and be set at naught?" If John's work saw the complete fulfilment of the preparation for the Messiah and his kingdom, where is the place of Christ's suffering? The descent of Jesus to the plain bears a striking resemblance to the coming of Moses from the mount. From the glory, harmony, and peace of heaven, he returns to discord, mockery, and unbelief on the earth. three factors were responsible for the scene which he witnessed. The nine remaining disciples had lost their Lord, and with him had gone their faith. An urgent case of need had come to test that faith. And the scribes, no longer content for Jesus to come into their midst, had tracked him up the Jordan Valley. A man had brought his terribly afflicted son to be healed, and learning the whereabouts of Jesus, probably from the people of Caesarea Philippi, he came to the foot of the mount, followed by crowds from the city. In the absence of Jesus, the man had appealed to the disciples, but they had proved impotent. This presented a wonderful opportunity for the scribes, who took full advantage of their failure to bring ridicule upon their Lord. So it was that the Son of Man returned from receiving the glory and honour of his Father to encounter the mockery and unbelief of men. His coming had a profound effect upon the people. Mark tells us, "And straightway all the people, when they beheld him, were greatly amazed, and running to him, saluted him." We wonder whether the disturbance fully accounts for their amazement and greeting. Is it not possible that the light of God's glory still lingered about him? And is it not a significant contrast that when Moses came down from the mount, his shining face brought fear to the people, but the coming of Christ from his Father's presence brought warmth and joy? With his coming, the tumult ceased. The scribes were embarrassed by their accusations, the disciples by their failure. "What question ye with them?" But the scribes, so quick to condemn him in his absence, had nothing to say. The explanation was made by the man who was responsible for the disturbances. Kneeling before Jesus, he told him that he had brought his only son, who was pining away in the grip of epilepsy. He was dumb and so terribly afflicted that he writhed foaming on the earth, gnashing his teeth. "And," he said, "I spake to thy disciples that they should cast him out, and they could not." The cry of Jesus seems to have in it something of the contrast between the mountain heights and this vale of tears, the glory of the Father's presence and the reproach of men. It has in it, too, the yearning for the completion of his work, that all his suffering and discord may cease. It was a cry of protestation which included them all, the mocking scribes, the unbelieving disciples, the anxious father. "O faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I suffer you?" But his rebuke was no refusal. His impatience of the wilful need of man was not impatience of his ministry of love. That is inexhaustible. Until death itself is swallowed up in victory, the gracious invitation will remain: "Bring him unto me." Coming to Jesus, the poor youth was seized with a paroxysm such as the Father had described. Jesus watched him as he writhed at his feet. The commotion that had followed the disciples' failure, the challenge of the scribes, the shouting of the people, had made the atmosphere a tense and difficult background for the calm confidence of faith. Jesus sought to bring peace into the disturbed heart of the Father, which would inspire in him that belief which alone would save his son. Seeking, as he always did, those adequate grounds of faith, Jesus turned to the man and asked him how long he had been like this. "Of a child," he answered, and took the opportunity of telling him more of the effect of the malady on his son. So great was his distress that the boy lost all control of his faculties, often falling into the fire and water. "But," he cried in sudden entreaty, "if thou canst do anything, have compassion on us and help us." O foolish man, let the greatness of thy need excuse thy faithless heart. As well may he take a bucket to the brink of the fathomless ocean and cry, "If thou canst." With infinite love, Jesus turned the question round, and doing so gave him an impetus for faith. He was looking pleadingly at Jesus, yearning to see his son restored. Jesus led him back to the inmost recesses of his own heart. "Do not demand it of me. I am willing." "Demand it of yourself. If thou canst believe." His son was in his hands. His faith alone could release the power that Jesus was willing to give. In a moment the man saw it. A spark of grace had been kindled in his heart, and by its light he saw for the first time the depths of his faithlessness. It will always be so. Jesus alone can reveal to us the exceeding sinfulness of sin. He alone can show us the fetters of unbelief chaining us to our prison wall. The father realized he could be his own son's worst enemy. Implicit in that knowledge was his belief in Jesus. He cried out pathetically yet triumphantly, "Lord, I believe. Help thou mine unbelief." Clinging desperately to Jesus, conscious only of his insufficiency, but praying for help, he was, all unknowingly, a wonderful example of true faith. For what can we add to that? Tears of penitence, acknowledgement of weakness, words of profound conviction. These are the ingredients of faith. We hardly need to hear the sequel. "And Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the child and delivered him again to his father." When they were alone, the 9 disciples asked Jesus why they had so dismally failed. "Because of your unbelief," he answered. "For verily I say unto you, if ye have faith as a grain of mustard seed, ye shall say to this mountain, remove hence to yonder place, and it shall removed, and nothing shall be impossible unto you. Howbeit this kind goeth not out, but by prayer." They had thought that they had faith in him, but it was a profession grown languid in the ebb and flow of daily life. It was not a faith which could win for them a place with their companions on the heights of Hermon, nor save the name of their Lord from shame on the plains below. The faith that Jesus required of them was an intense, vitalizing force which sought only the kingdom of God and his righteousness, that was sustained by prayer. Faith of that kind, though only as small as the proverbial mustard seed, could remove mountains. The smallest faith, if it is true faith, can overcome the greatest obstacles, because it is the channel which links the believer to the infinite power of God. Without it we can do nothing. With it we can do all things.